Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Whoever said nice guys finish last wasn't a top-notch evolutionary biologist, because it's not always true. There are many examples, even in the non-human world, of those competing to pass on their genes by not being the most aggressive and doing quite well. So what does that mean? What does it say about altruism? Many psychologists and philosophers have argued that there is no such thing as true altruism, but can be nice. Truly nice, also be truly selfless. So we invite you into our conversation. Are you really nice, or are you have some sort of motivation going on out there? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. Does altruism exist? 210-614-8980. You can email your questions and comments to The Source at tpr.org. And we're joined by David Sloan Wilson, author of Does Altruism Exist? Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. David, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much.
So altruism has been called a paradoxical trait because it appears to counter the prime directive of evolution, which is to survive. So is altruism a paradoxical trait?
Yes and no. So there's good news and bad news when it comes to altruism. The bad news is that altruists, because they're helping others, are vulnerable to exploitation, basically. And so if that was the only story, then altruism could not exist in a Darwinian sense. But the good news of altruism is that when altruists get to interact with each other, then they succeed very well in groups compared to groups of selfish individuals. And so those two forces together maintain both altruists and non-altruists in a population, and that explains the human population pretty well. Pretty well, in addition.
So, as Darwin said, "Don't be a chump. You may be a chimp, but you don't be a chump." Basically.
I don't know where that is in the Origin of Species, but yes, that's the gist of it.
I think it was Descent of Mankind. Humor. We have to worry, because the idea is that, you know, if you're aggressive, then you're able to – you're a better job at passing your genes along down the line. That's your objective. You want to pass your genes down the line. So if selection, natural selection, rewards aggression, then we should just have a whole society of psychopaths, right?
Yes, and you know, there's some species that are like that. There's some societies that we would not want to live in because that evolutionary pressure has been the one that's the strongest. And you end up with, you'd call them nightmare societies, in which it really is a brutal struggle, and the strongest and the most selfish win. But fortunately, not all societies need to be like that.
Well, don't we have, why aren't we like that with humanity then? We're all still trying to be Top Gun, right?
No, I mean, often we can succeed through teamwork. And as a species, teamwork is our specialty. We are more cooperative than any other primate species. And it's that cooperativeness that causes us to be so different. Because when you look at all the things that set us apart from other species that make us so unique, including our cultures and our degree of cooperation with unrelated individuals. All of these are examples of succeeding as teams, and especially in small groups. When somebody tries to push their weight around and to be a bully, usually the other members of the group have a way of holding that in check. So there's a lot of social control that takes place, especially in small groups, that keeps them on an even keel and prevents selfishness from succeeding.
Right, and this is in chimps also. You know, if there's one dominant chimp and he doesn't have his allies, then the others will gang up on him.
Yep, there's quite a bit of this takes place in chimps, but all things considered, chimps are obsessed with being the dominant chimp in their own group, and there's so much rivalry among individuals within a group that they're actually not all that cooperative, at least compared to us, and also that other species, the bonobos, that are as closely related to us as chimps.
Yeah, the fascinating species. Let's go to the phone lines. The number is 210-614-8980. Let's get Clifford on the air. Hey, Clifford, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that altruism, it's important, but I don't know that it's ever truly something that you don't receive a benefit from. You know, they've done studies where if people, you know, get a certain amount of money and spend it on other people, they're happier with the results, happier with themselves than if they spent it on themselves. And that, and in just doing things for other people, there is, you know, there's not an unsubstantial benefit to yourself. So, you know, it's different than how we normally would view, you know, give and take, but there's still something there that you are getting back, whether it's, you know, the mirror neurons or neurotransmitters or something. There is a benefit to you for it.
Okay. Clifford, good point. Appreciate that. So, David Sloan Wilson, reciprocation somehow, whether it be a little squirt of dopamine in the brain or higher self-esteem, but you're going to get something out of putting a little extra in the collection plate.
Absolutely. And it's very important to distinguish altruism, what I call at the level of action, what you actually do for others at some expense to yourself, and altruism at the level of thoughts and feelings, how you think about it and how you feel about it as you're doing that that action. And not to be too picky about motives, because really the most important thing is what you do. And there's often many ways to think or feel about it. So if it makes you feel good to help others, or if it improves your reputation, these are not bad things. These are not, you know, somehow less pure than altruism. So we should be focused on getting people to do the right thing. And as to exactly how they think and feel as they do it, we should be quite flexible. And I think most people are like that in everyday life. That's my experience.
So the level of thoughts and feelings of altruism has to lead to the level of action in order to actually mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, everything we do for some reason, some mental events that cause us to do it.
Yeah, but if we just think about nice things for other people, we don't actually provide those nice things. Is that actually altruism?
In terms of how we think about it, maybe. But most people would say no. If you're not walking the walk, then who cares how you think about it? And it's curious that most religions, enduring religions, they do an excellent job of getting people to behave for the good of the group. But in terms of the motivation that's instilled by religion, very often that's in terms of such things as personal salvation. So what religious beliefs tell us is that if we do the right thing, then everyone's going to go to benefit. We'll go to heaven, they'll go to heaven. And if we do the wrong thing, everyone will lose. And that, as I think you can see, is much more motivating than to actually think of it as, oh, okay, you know, if I do this, then someone will benefit or I won't. That's kind of too complex. And most religions are more simple than that in terms of their belief structure. And they portray it as a win-win or a lose-lose situation. They avoid the messy situation in which I gain and you don't, or vice versa.
If you got a comment or an idea, a question about altruism, we'd love to hear it. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. We've got David Sloan Wilson on the line. Does altruism exist? His book, Genes, Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. We'll be right back after this. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. It's nice to be nice to the nice, but is that altruism? Does altruism actually exist? That's the book written by David Sloan Wilson, subtitled Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. Let's get a caller on the air with Hugh. Hugh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, your guest is doing a pretty good job of overcoming the definition of the word simplistic, which is to simplify something to the point of stupidity, which happens all the time with Darwin. Survival of the fittest came from Mr. Spencer, not Darwin, and he had a whole other agenda. If you look at the micro level in the cell, there are parts of our cells that used to be other organisms. And your body as it stands, most of the cells in it did not come from your mother. And at the macro level, there's domestication of both plants and animals, where both the humans and the plants were domesticated to each other. Also, there's the prisoner's dilemma studies you might want to discuss.
Okay, Hugh, thank you very much. Dr. David Sloan.
Well, Hugh, that's a very informed example, lots to talk about. But let me pick out this idea of a society being like an organism and an organism being like a society. This is one of the most exciting discoveries of evolutionary science. So we are literally highly regulated groups, our genes and our cells are really like a highly regulated society. And the idea that our groups, our societies, can be like an organism, in a sense, are like an organism or should be like an organism, is both old and new. Basically, that idea goes back a long way. But against the background of the last 50 years of intellectual thought, which has been so very individualistic, as if everything has to be understood in terms of self-interest. All of economic theory is like that, and we're really brainwashed over the last 50 years in thinking of the individual as the fundamental unit that exists out there. But to think of the group as like that is both old and new, as I said. But it's coming back, and some of the points that you made are all in that direction.
So what about issues of like bloodline proximity? If I have I can't save myself, but I can save my child or my brother, or because then my genes may not be able to carry on, but then theirs will, and in a sense, that's an extension of me.
Yeah, so nepotism, basically helping kin, blood is thicker than water. This is very important, but it's not the only thing. And often evolutionary theory has been interpreted to mean that the only people that you should help are your relatives, but that's not true at all. Many scenarios in which we also help unrelated individuals, and that's especially true of our own species. We're helping non-relatives all the time. But what is important is for those altruists to be helping other altruists. If they're in a position to be exploited by more selfish individuals, then of course that's a recipe for failure. So there does have to be a sorting mechanism. There does have to be a sense in which those who give do receive, but it need not be through genealogical relatives, not necessarily blood kin.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines with Eduardo. Eduardo, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hey there.
I would argue that an example of selflessness is prevalent in the volunteer firefighter culture. In small towns, friends and family take on these roles mainly because they do care about others, and it's not the only motivator, it's the primary motivator. It becomes the survival of the town or the group more than the survival of self.
Okay, good question. Thank you, Eduardo, for calling in.
Now, that's Eduardo, that's a great question. And firefighters in small towns, I think, are both examples of what we're talking about. First, the need for firefighting. So here you have a situation in which you have a problem, houses catching on fire, which needs a solution. That solution is very complicated. It involves all kinds of group activities, everything from raising the money for the fire trucks to the people that actually man it, often on a volunteer basis. So these are all examples of altruism defined in terms of action. And when you then see, what causes them to do it, meant in terms of their thoughts and feelings, it's a whole mix of things, including prestige, being respected for doing it, but also a sheer love of doing it, and a willingness to sacrifice yourself, often to the death, for your fellow firefighter. So I think that's a wonderful microcosm, basically, of what we're talking about, and what we want to implement often at a larger scale. But you also have to keep in mind that sometimes these groups become very strong, but they're hostile to other groups. So altruism actually turns into selfishness, not in the case of firefighters, but in the case of military groups and so on and so forth. You see the best and the worst. You see the best altruism within groups and the worst hostility between groups. Altruism becomes selfishness at a higher level very often.
So this really leads into talking about the tribalism, tribes, and the original tribes, small bands of proto-humans, roaming the Serengeti, trying, you know, you cannot survive as an individual. You are dependent upon a tribe, right?
Yep.
And so one tribe is competing against another tribe, particularly in times of mega drought and scarcity. And so if you have some level of altruism and everyone is looking out for each other, then that tribe is going to do better versus the epicureal tribe where everyone just wants to have a good time.
Basically, you described it very well. That's the basic dynamic. And whether tribes, Darwin had made a point that nature is not always violent. Plants often compete against the climate, not against other plants. And it's also true for groups, that groups compete against each other, not by direct conflict, but simply by doing better as a group. At the same time, they also compete through direct conflict, and it would be hard to underestimate the importance of warfare in human history. Often groups are very well designed to succeed at the expense of other groups. This is part of our legacy, and something that we have to manage in the present day, where we have very very disposed towards making in-group, out-group distinctions and disparaging other members of the out-group.
So your subtitle is Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. So is altruism cultural or genetic?
It is both, and it's so important to think of this in cultural terms. This is not just a contest of genes, but it's a contest of cultural traits and a contest of what I call social strategies, how we decide to behave on a moment-by-moment basis. All of us are capable of being altruistic or selfish, and the question is, what's going to be the best strategy, and how can we create social environments in which altruism is the best strategy? A lot of the dysfunction that we see in everyday life is based on the fact that the social environment rewards selfishness and punishes altruism. And if you counsel someone to be altruistic under those circumstances, you don't do them any favor at all. In fact, it's unethical to tell someone to be altruistic when they're in a social environment that's going to punish them for helping others. What you need to do is create a social environment that rewards altruism, and then people will become altruistic without being told.
But then you had, philosophers like Friedrich Nietzsche who maintained that this was a ploy in order to keep the your alpha male down.
That's right, and Nietzsche was this is represented in great intellectual traditions, the Enlightenment, and that's what makes it so fun. I think that these ideas, as I say in my book, are as foundational as the ideas associated with the Enlightenment and the early days of evolutionary theory. This was what Hobbes was talking about, and Hume and Nietzsche. These are the ideas that we need to continue to talk about, and I think that that what we know as scientists, and especially applying evolutionary theory to our own situation, enables us to operate as philosophers and to think about these great ideas and also to implement them in real-world situations. How do you make a neighborhood work better, a business, a school? All of these, I think, are social environments that can be constructed to favor cooperation or not, and it's more or less up to us to create social environments that favor altruism.
So you're saying that we should figure out ways to exploit these genes and this attitude that we need to help others, and so that we can have a better, stronger society?
Yes, I do. I'm unashamed of saying that. And in many ways, we are like snails. We're capable of pulling into our shells when we feel unsafe, and then opening up when we feel more safe and secure. And in this case, that pulling in and opening up is how we extend ourselves to others. We've done experiments where we show people photographs of dangerous-looking neighborhoods, and then they play a game in which they can either cooperate or not. And guess what? You show them the photograph of a dangerous-looking neighborhood, and they elect not to cooperate. you show them a photograph of a nice neighborhood, and they cooperate. And so they are able to switch back and forth between being altruistic or selfish at a moment's notice, like a snail or a chameleon. We all have that capability.
All right. So the question is, does altruism exist, and what's the answer?
Well, the answer is yes, but in a kind of a conditional way. But the idea that we're all selfish and that everything we do is to benefit ourselves, I think, is just flat out incorrect.
So collectivism wins. Yay.
That's right.
All right. David Sloan Wilson, thank you so much. Does Altruism Exist is the book, Culture, Genes, and the Welfare of Others. This is The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for tuning in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is produced by Paul Flab and David Martin Davies. Elena Soros is our intern. Our engineer is Doug DeMore. Management and oversight provided by News Director Shelley Koffler and VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Production assistance is provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation and the GAC Health Foundation.